Hello and welcome to a podcast where we take fictional science from comics, movies, TV, etc. and try to make it factually, scientifically, possibly real. I'm Stoby.
I am known as Forgan.
And I'm Stu.
And this is The Science of Fiction.
Pick up the tricorder, put it on your head. Scanning the planet, see if anyone is dead. Autonomous car driving in Zanzibar. Beam me up, Scotty, I'm not that far. Android hoovering, tearing up the place. Flip phones and conference calls, friends in outer space. Astrophysicist sitting on my knee. Asking aliens if they like a cup of tea.
Fiction, to the science of fiction. I've got an addiction to the science of fiction. I've got an addiction, baby, to the science of fiction. I've got an addiction to the science of fiction.
Welcome back to episode 4 of the Science of Fiction season 2. The End of the World series.
The End of the World as We Know It series.
And it's just nearly the end of the day, thankfully. So this is the 4th episode we've recorded in the same day. So that's quite an achievement.
We haven't killed each other yet.
No, yeah, not yet. Not even close.
Yeah.
So, as you've heard, I am joined as always by Dr. Duncan Forgan and...
Not a doctor.
Messer Stu McIntyre.
I am very messy. Hello.
How's it going, guys?
Yeah, good.
It's been a whole 20 minutes since we last recorded anything.
I'm hanging in there.
We've had a bit of a journey. We've discovered how Duncan watches TV.
But let's not repeat
that first. Oh, God.
Right. So what are we talking about today?
Today?
Again.
For this episode.
Because we've talked about other things today.
We have talked about other things today.
What are we talking about in this episode?
In this specific episode?
This one?
Well, yeah, this one. Right here.
The one right here?
Yeah.
Okay. The one we're recording right now.
We've been doing this a very long time.
It's been a good day.
So today's topic is nuclear war.
What is it good for?
Absolutely nothing.
Sing it again, brother.
Yeah, so we're here to talk about, well, can we wipe ourselves out with a nuclear war?
Quite probably.
And the answer seems to be yes.
Yeah.
I mean, and that was a science fiction.
Even shorter than the last episode.
I think it's one of those things is like, mutually, there's also the aspect of like mutually assured destruction.
Yeah.
And can you cause, is it possible, does it have to be nuclear weapons? Mm. Is there an alternative, like, a weapon of mass destruction that isn't going to basically just turn the entire world into a wasteland faster than we're going to do that by climate change?
Mm.
Episode 1, 2.
Oh!
So close. We'll edit it.
Absolutely not. That's the first mistake we've made, and it wasn't me.
Yeah, so I guess, well, why don't we kind of round off the nuclear war thing? We'll talk a bit about some of the examples in fiction. There's some really excellent discussions of, like, the madness of mad.
Oh, yeah.
Of mutually assured destruction. I mean, Doctor Strangelove is still a classic. I love that film.
Like, the Doomsday Clock as well is that sort of thing that we put in place. And it's like, how close are we to nuclear destruction? And he's like, why do we even have this?
Yeah, well, the Doomsday Clock is now not just about nuclear weapons, right? I think it was first established to say, well, like, how close are we to launching missiles? But now it's more, it does take into account other things. It talks about, like, bioterrorism, so biological weapons could be a weapon of mass destruction.
Yeah.
Nanotechnology, I think, is in there. And I think climate change has now been added to it as well. So it's, you know, they're talking about all different sort of existential risks that we have.
It's nice to know that there are so many people in the world keeping a track of how badly we're doing as a race that we're going to potentially wipe ourselves out.
Yes, here's the I'm screwed clock.
Yeah.
And we're even closer to midnight than ever before. Yeah, it's pretty strange.
It's a real up episode, this one, isn't it?
I know. This whole season is just so positive.
I know.
Well, that's the thing. When you go with it, it's the end of the world series.
Yes.
You've kind of got to accept that there's got to be a bit of negativity in there.
It's going to be a bit grim.
Yeah. So... let's talk about mutually assured destruction.
Yeah.
Okay. The one thing that oddly keeps us safe is this threat of mutually assured destruction.
Yeah.
Because if one country decides, I'm going to bomb the hell, I want to, you cut that country, the other country's going to go, well, I know you're going to do that, so don't worry, I'm going to bomb the bomb you just as bad.
Yeah.
And it just escalates and escalates until, I said, mutually assured destruction. Everyone gets destroyed because then nobody survives.
It's a crazy doctrine, but it's based in mathematics. It's based in something called game theory. And it's this idea that, you know, we're two players, right? And we have two moves to make. Either I do or don't press the button. And I have to decide whether I'm going to press the button based on what I think you're going to do once I've pressed the button. And if you've explained really clearly to me, if you press the button, I am also pressing the button. And you're like, okay, I don't want you to press the button, so I'm not going to press the button. And that's, and you're saying the exact same thing to me, and that's how it all holds together. But it's mad that that's all it comes down to. Like, our entire future is down to basically two people, because there are essentially two people who are holding the keys, the nuclear football. There's the president of the United States, and then there is the person on the other side who used to be the president of the Soviet Union, to some extent now is the president of Russia or other countries that have the nuclear capability. It's the same argument. It's like, okay, we're going to play this game. Are you going to press the button? Because if you press the button, I will press the button.
It's the highest stakes game of chicken.
It is.
It's like, it reminds me of Golden Balls.
Yeah.
You know, at the end where you split or steal and you have to convince your opponent that you're going to share the money.
Yeah.
And that, but at the end of the day, you can turn around and be like, I've stolen. The only thing is, the other person doesn't have the reaction time. You've both got to make your decision then and then.
Yeah.
This is slightly different because you've still got reaction. It's like, I can't believe you just did that to me. I'm going to do that back.
Yeah. But that's it. You have like minutes to decide. Because, you know, once a missile's launched, the way the launchers are going to work is they're going to take a shortcut to you. They're going to go probably over the poles if it's the case of Russia and the United States continents. And they're going to go over the poles. You've got minutes of reaction time. And it's like, okay, it takes me several minutes to conduct a full launch. I basically have 6 minutes to decide whether to press the button or not.
Which is where the Mark Owen song came from. 6 minutes left to go.
4 minutes.
4 minutes.
4 minute warning.
Oh, sorry. I got
that wrong. Was that about nuclear destruction?
Yeah.
That was not in the video.
I love that song. I feel like I've talked about this on a podcast already, but I love that song because when he says 4 minutes left to go,
it is 4 minutes left.
There's 4 minutes of the song left, and then the next chorus it's 3 minutes, and then 2 minutes, and each chorus, each verse.
I like the consistency. I mean, Mark Owen, great musician, fantastic timer.
I prefer the timing part. I like that song. I don't like much of his other stuff, but he was quite good at my Freshers Week.
Yeah.
So there you go. But that's mainly because it was a live band, and I'm a sucker for a live band.
Mm.
Not like a groupie, but like I enjoy a live band.
Okay.
Just to clarify,
just gently walk over that.
Just to clarify again, live band rather than an undead band.
Yeah.
I've lost the train completely.
So we're talking mutually assured destruction.
Nuclear annihilation.
So essentially there's that situation where it's like you're not going to blow it up because if you blow us up, I'm going to blow you up, and that's it.
Yeah.
Now there's always been this little talk of the anti-nuclear systems.
Yeah.
The infamous Star Wars system that was touted. I don't know if it was in the 80s. Was it Reagan?
It was Reagan. Was a big fan of it, but it never came to be. And the idea was that simply, if your enemy launches satellites, you destroy the launch the weapon. You'd have a satellite deployed somewhere in space that destroys it for you, like either with a kinetic weapon or with a laser.
What if it misses?
Yeah. That was the problem. That's why it never got made.
Yeah,
because I think he discovered that it wasn't going to hit very often.
Do you know? Like, I'm pretty certain there's an episode of The West Wing where it focuses on this whole thing. It's like it's an anti nuclear. It's not like I'm going to test it. But, what happened? It missed by about 4 miles. Didn't even get close.
Superheated the ocean. Yeah. We've got a bit of a problem.
So, but like it's that weird thing. Like the only thing holding everything back is this game of chicken. Like there's no real viable defense other than that.
No, so it's a steal that I promise you make to that person. Like if you kill me, I will kill you.
Like a bridge by the keystone. You know, and it's just the two opposing forces pushing against
exactly
the keystone
the same way. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's absolutely right. Yeah.
So, Dr. Strangelove, I have no idea what this is about, so can someone explain it to me?
So, Dr. Strangelove is a description of basically how the world ends, and it ends by accident. And I'm trying to remember all the exact details of all the things that go wrong, but essentially, there is a rogue colonel decides to launch a strike against the Soviet Union.
Right.
And he decides just to do it and get on with things. And then the whole film is about how the US are trying to convince the Soviet Union that It's just one guy. He's mad. He thinks that you guys would put fluorine in the water to make us sterile. He's crazy, right? But at the same time, they're like, look, we're probably not going to be able to convince the Russians that this is actually going to work. And the Russians have this thing where if it's basically a clock that if they don't keep resetting the clock, it will launch all the nukes.
Ah, okay.
Right? So that's their bit of the mad thing, saying, look, if we can't keep this thing going, we will launch, we'll basically activate this weapon that destroys everything on the planet Earth. And so the whole film is kind of a dark comedy about how they're trying to deal with this problem. And it's brilliantly done because you have that, like, the president speaking to his counterpart. And it's all you hear is his side. You never hear the Soviet president's side. And it's the conversations are really, really funny. It's all Peter Sellers as well. And he's just, Peter Sellers is great. But at the same time, they're trying to stop the destruction of mankind or humanity. But at the same time, they're also saying, well, we're probably not going to achieve it. So let's try and come up with a plan to survive. And they come up with a really rubbish plan to survive. And it's basically the film poking holes in the fact that it's not going to work. And yeah, it's just a really good description of how at that time, there was very little between us and complete annihilation, because the mad principle relies on the president's having control. But if somebody else has control and decides not to play the game, it doesn't work, right? Mm-hmm. And yeah, I think it's still something that that could be a problem. You know, I mean, yeah.
I mean, it's a major factor in the War Games movie.
Yes,
because I've not watched it in a very long time.
That's a classic film, though.
But it's this whole sort of like there's a computer system that controls all of the nukes in America, and they have to basically show it that like there are games where you can just draw. Like,
yeah.
And essentially they teach it tic-tac-toe.
Yes.
And to get it to play against itself. And like every single time it draws, it's like, oh, okay, so there isn't just a win-loss situation. Like, sometimes stalemate is the best option.
Yeah. So again,
going back to AI.
Yeah. It's a brilliant film because the crux of it is
Broderick's a dream.
Okay. All right. So the crux of the film is that Broderick is a hacker and manages to convince the machine to start playing a game. He thinks he's playing a game, but the machine is actually playing out a war game scenario, and it's also sending out information that is convincing the Russians that this is happening for real. And the end of the game, at the end of the story, is that they basically teach it how to play against itself, and then it realizes that there are only really two options. One is either we all die or we don't play, and the best way to win is not to play. And it realizes that, and it stops everything, and it says, right, okay. And it basically, you can see it, and it's quite a fun sort of section. At the end, you can see it playing through different scenarios of like, oh, who launches first? Or actually, maybe it's not the Americans that launch. Maybe there's a war in India versus Pakistan, and that starts an exchange over here, and this doesn't work. But I always enjoyed that bit at the end of it, saying, okay, the only way to win is not to play. And it's kind of true, and it's the way that we've managed to win as a species for the last, what is it? 60-odd, 70 years since.
Yeah, don't go that far.
Since we invented nuclear weapons, yeah.
Did you know there's an interesting fact that all Geiger counters have to be created from metal from sunken battleships in the ocean? Because when the first atomic bomb was released into the world and it went off, it fundamentally changed the atmosphere of the Earth.
Yeah.
And it went down to all the metals of everything because of that. And that these metals are the only metals in the world now that are unaffected by said radioactivity, which obviously Geiger counters are very sensitive to.
Oh, okay.
So like all Geiger counters are made from these remnants of old battleships that were sunk before 1945.
So I mean, we've got a finite number of Geiger counters.
I mean, I don't know how we're going to deal with it. I don't think it's going to affect Geiger counter stocks, but let's not use up all the Geiger counters now. But I just thought I would share that because I thought it was a very interesting fact. I was going to actually share a couple of episodes, and then I thought, no, I'll keep that one because it didn't make much sense.
The thing is, in Chernobyl, like one of the Geiger counters they pull out after the incident, it just breaks itself because it's exposed to beyond 3.6. What's the word?
Roentgens.
Yes.
Yeah.
And it, or 2.8 or whatever the
limit is. Yeah.
The limit on that, and it just broke itself. Yeah. So
That's a brilliant series.
I've only seen three episodes.
I'll watch the end.
I know, I need to.
It's really good.
Like, I haven't watched it, not that interested in it. I've heard
have you
this,
listened to the podcast?
No, I didn't realise it was a podcast.
There's the podcast with Craig Mazin, the writer.
Is it Craig? Okay.
And another guy from HBO. And there's five podcasts, one per episode as well. Okay. It's fascinating.
I need to catch up. Yeah. That's really good. Chernobyl's a tremendous series. It's a really hard watch. You can watch one at a time and just go, and then go to bed and have nightmares about your children. But, you know,
I always have nightmares about my children.
I couldn't watch it. I also heard something about not being able to eat bolognese pasta at the same time. And someone on Twitter basically said, "I'm so glad I ate bolognese pasta before I watched Chernobyl."
Yeah, it's pretty hard for you, but it's utterly fascinating.
The thing is, like, people are comparing it and saying it's better than Breaking Bad, better than Game of Thrones and all that, and you can't compare five episodes against 60 odd.
And also it's real.
It's absolutely a different genre.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's not
it's just because it's rated higher. Less chance to mess up.
Yeah, it's a well-contained story, and it's also just fascinating just to see how you deal with what they were concerned at that point. I think about episode three, they were like, this could be a planetary scale catastrophe.
Mm-hmm.
And they were right. In some ways, it could have been. And they had to think very quickly and, you know, use pretty sort of dicey techniques to fix it because they didn't have a choice. Mm-hmm. They couldn't be seen to be losing face in front of the international community.
Which is crazy because it should just be the priority. But that's just how it was at the time.
That's just how it was. It was politics. And again, there's a little bit of that mad thing going on there saying, if you can't handle a nuclear reactor, how can you handle your nuclear weapons? Maybe I can push the button on you. Mm. You know, and so all these things are going on in the background. It's just...
I can't wait to see what season two will bring.
So, we've obviously talked about what the effects of mutual assured destruction are and what's going on there. But with these sort of weapons of mass destruction... Obviously, currently nuclear weapons are the biggest one, but I mean, and we very briefly touched on it, that there are other weapons of mass destruction, other things that could lead to this sort of doomsday, biological weapons, and other things like that. I mean, are there clean weapons of mass destruction? Could they exist?
What do you mean by clean?
As in, don't leave behind massive amount of radiation.
Oh, sure. I mean,
like you could still
in the same way a bullet.
You could still basically bomb the hell out of someone, but you wouldn't leave it as an irradiated wasteland.
Right, okay. So are you talking about like destroying buildings and things like that?
Yeah, basically, you could still do the tactical hits and the heavy levels of destruction, but without being a situation where, oh yeah, cool, that whole continent's pretty much unlivable now.
The reason that you have loads of radiation in these areas or you have like hazardous environments is because you're concentrating enormous amounts of energy into a single device, right? So if you're wanting to use that energy to blow up a building or to cause damage to a city, you're going to get very intense sites of radiation. And that's where the fallout comes from. And it's where all the harmful radiation then exits and then, you know, comes into our bodies or, you know, into the environment. So if you're wanting to make a weapon that destroys buildings on a large scale, you kind of have to deal with the radiation. That's a nuclear weapon you've built. If you want to build a weapon that leaves the buildings intact, doesn't necessarily make the place unlivable, but gets rid of the human population, then you can use a biological weapon or a chemical weapon, right? And these fall under the weapons of mass destruction sort of category. And sometimes they get referred to as like NBC, nuclear, biological, chemical. And so when governments are training their military personnel or their service personnel, they train against NBC. They train against that. You could release a strain of virus that affects humans, doesn't really affect animals, that is deadly, right?
ALZ-113?
Which is?
The Alzheimer's cure from Planet of the Apes.
Oh, very good. Okay. Yeah. So, you know, that's an example of a weapon of mass destruction that destroyed human civilization.
But it wasn't a weapon. That was the thing.
It wasn't a weapon.
It was a leak from a test.
Oh, yeah. So that's where you could argue it was weaponized.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe. But it wasn't intended as a weapon. But imagine if somebody had said, you've made a weapon. I want to now just I want to inject into this population. The problem they had there, of course, is that people take flights and fly out of the city.
The second person to be infected was a pilot.
Yes, and that was the biggest part of it, is that that mm-hmm. person flies all over the world, everyone on the aircraft is infected.
But how many times has that been where someone's doing some research or development and whatever they end up developing has then gone on to be used for something else? Perfect example, Viagra.
Yes.
Viagra was not meant to give you stiffies. It was meant to
that's the quote else. Of the episode. Can that be the title of this?
if you want to draw it back into a previous episode,
yes.
It's not meant to give you throbbers. initially.
Weapons of mass destruction. Or mass distraction, I guess.
Yeah.
But that is the thing. Like,
yeah.
It was, and that is, again, what you see in that. Mm-hmm. Look, this has become a weaponized because it does this thing.
Yes.
So it was never meant to be that.
Yes. Yeah. And yeah, you can imagine that the Planet of the Apes scenario is a little bit fantastic, but not hugely, right? This idea that maybe you do something with good purposes, but maybe it has an unintended consequence, and if you let out in the lab, it's going to do something bad. Yeah, so
28 days later,
zombie films generally have that kind of premise, right? They're doing something with monkeys, and then it all goes wrong, and the monkey bites somebody, and then they become zombies. Yeah.
In DC Comics at the moment, they've got a deceased storyline going on, where everyone becomes zombies, but the distribution for it is screens. So your smartphone, your tablets, your TVs, everything. And it just so happens that Superman, Lois Lane, and a few others aren't watching TV or looking at their phones when it all kicks off.
Yeah.
Batman figures out it's a screen mm-hmm. by looking at his screen. So he's out of the picture, but he lets them know. And so Oliver, Queen, and Dinah Lance and that. Even Green Lantern's been turned because he was looking at a screen at the time, and things like that. And I thought that was quite an interesting idea. It's covered, it's kind of, from a hypnosis point, it's done in Incredibles to a very localized degree.
Yeah.
But the idea of distribution through screens, if they could reprogram your physiology in that way.
Mm. Teen Titans go to the movies, that's the main focus, like it's controlling that way.
Right. I only got about 20 minutes into that film.
I love that movie.
But that would be a very effective way. And like you said in the last episode, we're all enslaved. To our screens in certain ways.
Yeah.
So that would be a hell of a distribution method if it's possible. So that was just a little side thing because
it's kind of connected, So yeah, like if you wanted to release like a virus, if you wanted to affect a smaller area, maybe a chemical weapon is better. And, we've, as a species, been quite harsh on people who develop chemical weapons. There's an interesting kind of contradiction between, the big superpowers having nuclear weapons but nobody having chemical weapons, and the discussions about how you use chemical weapons in compound zones and stuff. It's weird, the distinctions that we draw in saying this is fine, or at least we're going to let this situation stand because we can't really change it. This situation we don't like.
Yeah,
don't do that.
It's like chemical weapons are inhumane, so we're not using them.
Yeah, okay.
It's fine to kill masses of people in another way, or let them die slowly of radiation.
Yeah,
to make their eyeballs turn to blood and burn or whatever is just as inhumane.
Definitely not watching Chernobyl.
That doesn't happen in Chernobyl.
No.
What's up, Fair City Podcast? This is Chris and Dan from Fresh Talk. Check us out at freshtalkpodcast.com.
That's right. And if you had any idea how long it took me and Dan to do that bumper, you would actually probably never listen to us.
It's totally true. Get him, Stobie.
Hey, Stobie, it's me, Jarrett. Go to JarrettGoesToTheMovies.com. Check out the podcast. Also go to Rockstar Dad Show. Check that one out too. It's freaking great. They're both great. Also, you just got a text and a Facebook message. And I probably better give you this phone back.
Hello, this is Jim.
And my name is Graham Chen Jack.
And we're both responsible for the monstrosity that is A Bloody Mess Podcast.
We can be found at www.facebook.com/messpodcast, twitter.com/mess_podcast, Instagram is A Bloody Mess.
And we're our alternative Wednesdays to the Science of Fiction Podcast, which is a must listen.
So, the reason I ask about these sort of clean weapons of mass destruction or clean scene weapons, is there is a movie that essentially plays with the whole mutually assured destruction thing and almost solves it.
Right.
Because I don't know if either of you watched G.I. Joe Retaliation.
No.
Years ago.
So essentially in that situation, the Cobra have infiltrated the U.S. presidency. The president is under control of Cobra. They have the nuclear launch codes. And they build these satellites in space which have massive tungsten rods in them. Mm-hmm. And then towards the end of the movie, there's this big, almost like G8 conference where they've brought all the leaders of the world. And basically, as president of the United States, he launches the nuclear missiles. And everyone else who's there who has the nuclear missiles goes, "What the hell are you doing?" And they're going, "Well, I have to retaliate." Every single country then goes ding, 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 and launches a nuclear missile. So they're all up in the air, at which point crazy, crazy Cobra president then goes, "Oh, well, I'm then going to avert this whole thing by detonating all of my nuclear things. I was the first person to turn around and stop it."
Right.
Now, you guys are the ones who are still got one in the air. So now you guys are responsible for
what happens next.
At which point, every country then goes, "Oh, crap, 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 crap." And eventually, ding, 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 and they all definitely know. So at this point, everyone's arsenals are depleted.
Okay.
At which point, the gambit is played by Cobra, who really reveal these clean weapons of mass destruction, where it's these satellite weapons, orbital weapons, filled with these tungsten tubes. And basically, what they do is they launch them down, get them to a terminal velocity, and then they cause impact, and I think they basically destroy like London or so. Like your classic mass destruction movies of Independence Day esque. "Oh no, look, there goes the London Wheel." And that then becomes the big thing because nobody has nuclear weapons anymore. And the only one person with a big enough stick is Cobra.
Mm-hmm.
So they try and get them, and then obviously everything else plays out and they save the world. But By demonstrating this thing that there's like, yeah, if you get rid of the nuclear weapons and you have this clean option, we can destroy London or we can rebuild it the way we want to eventually, and it's not going to have that same issue of, "Oh, we've irradiated it, we've blown everything up," and it's still a fear because you've still got this mass weapon. So I just want to know, first of all, does the math work?
Right, okay.
Because we've gone 4 episodes into this series and we've done no math.
Are you missing it?
And I know that Duncan is chomping at the bit to drop some formulae.
I don't have time to come up with a website where you can muck around with this.
Maybe I'll do it later. Maybe we can come back to it.
But we've got time.
Yeah.
This is 8 weeks in the future from now.
Yeah, but I can't make it come into the present.
Okay. No, we don't have to do it now. Just explain it and then build it later.
Okay, so you mentioned terminal velocity, right, which is what I was getting at, what I was sending my math on my piece of paper. So what is terminal velocity? Okay, if you drop something and it's going to accelerate towards the ground, and the acceleration will be given by whatever gravity is, okay? So we're on the Earth, so little g is going to be 9.81 meters per second per second. So you start from zero, and it's going to increase its speed by 9.81 meters per second per second as it falls down.
Like if you drop a penny off the...
Like if you drop a penny off something, right? If you ignored the atmosphere, right? If it was dropping in a vacuum, that's how fast it would go. But the vacuum isn't there. It's actually an atmosphere. And so as your penny is falling down, the atmosphere is trying to resist, right? There's drag in the atmosphere. So there's going to be a point when the force of gravity is going to be matched by the drag force, okay? So there'll be a speed at which it stops going any faster. And we call that terminal velocity. So the rods that are being dropped in this scenario are going to reach terminal velocity and they're going to stay there. Okay, so the terminal velocity when you get at the top of the atmosphere is going to be a bit higher because there's less air, right? The density of air is a bit lower.
I was about to ask, obviously, if it's being launched in space.
So when it's launched in space, the first bit, before it hits the atmosphere, it can just drop it at you know, whatever acceleration it'll be. So it'll be mg. That'll be the force that you're pushing on it. So it's going down. It then hits the atmosphere and starts to slow down a bit. But the point is that by the time it gets to ground level, it will be at the velocity, the terminal velocity given by the density of air at that level, more or less, right? So I have something in front of me which can help me calculate the kinetic energy.
Is that a calculator?
I don't have a calculator. I have a piece of paper. Right.
He scribbled it all down. I scribbled it all down off the top of my head.
Genuinely looks like hieroglyphics.
Not on the top of his head, but off the top
so
of his head.
I mean, he could, but it would be pointless.
So the things we need to know are, how massive is the rod? How massive is your rod, Stu?
I don't want to disclose that information on a recording.
Okay, let's say that in this...
I mean, it looked pretty big in the movie.
Look.
Say no more.
So they're going to be probably like of order like 10 tons, shall we say?
Yeah, I mean...
10 times 1,000 squared. So I'm just going to do sort of rough... order of magnitude calculation here because I don't have a proper calculator in front of me. That is one. What? How? Like? So they're these big sort of cylinders?
Yeah, sort of. Like, yeah.
How far across? How long across do you think the bottom part is? Probably, so like, how big is the circle into the bottom of the cylinder?
I would imagine it'd be maybe a couple of feet maybe.
Okay, so we're saying they'll be like a meter across. So one. Yeah, roughly like...
It's been a while since I've watched the movie. I couldn't tell you the exact...
Yeah, so surface area, like, yeah, okay. And then drag coefficient is going to be the thing that then determines basically like how quickly we're going to get to be able to go. It's going to be something of order one. Okay, so that's 10 times 1,000. So that's 10 to the 4 squared is 10 to the 8. Multiplied by another 10 divided by 1. Okay, so you're talking like, yeah, about a billion joules. Okay. So, what we now need to work out is, how does that compare to a nuclear bomb?
Yeah.
Okay, so if someone can Google for me Hiroshima bomb, and we can figure out how much energy was in that. So it was 15 kilotons of TNT in the Hiroshima bomb. And then we'll know roughly how much kinetic energy is being delivered to the ground as this rod impacts.
No, we'll just Hiroshima bomb. This is not helping me, internet.
One kiloton in joules. Let's see if I can get the calculation this way.
In the meantime,
yeah.
Did you know that a velociraptor is just distance a raptor over time a raptor?
Okay, so if we multiply that, okay, we're going to get to zero.
In the meantime, as well, Duncan's doing some calculations, we should really talk about our generous hosts for today.
Yeah, so we are recording in the studio at Light Press Media and Design for all your media and design needs in Perth and the surrounding areas.
Yeah, and to be honest, we've recorded 4 episodes here today. It's been great fun. We're going to do another one in a minute. Or in an hour or so. But yeah, no, it's been really good. It's facilitated everything we've wanted to do. So yeah, mm-hmm. if you are looking for somewhere to record podcasts or do photography or anything like that, mm-hmm. it's a really good place to come and check out. So, and they also host our website as well.
Yeah, so he built and hosts our website as well. And that was a good price
okay.
as well. So, Forgan's on there. So yeah, Light Press Media and Design.
Okay, I think I'm done.
Okay.
So this is a tiny fraction of the Hiroshima bomb.
A tiny fraction of the Hiroshima bomb.
Yeah, if you assume it's 10 tons, then it comes out as about a 10,000th of the Hiroshima bomb. So it's not a very powerful explosion at all in that sense. But it's a pretty powerful bomb in terms of conventional weapons, right? Mm-hmm. So that's quite a big ways above. So you're talking... Well, actually, no. Let me just get this right. So you've got 10 to the minus 4 of this is 10 to the minus 3. So you've got zero. Yeah. So you're talking about, yeah, 100 kilograms of TNT.
100 kilograms of TNT. That's still quite a lot of TNT.
That's quite a lot of TNT. There's
probably definitely blow up a building.
Yes. Yeah.
Like if you wanted to do an orbital strike on a building.
Yeah.
And you could get the targeting system to work.
Yeah.
That's still pretty bad. I mean, I don't think the movie really gives it justice.
Yeah.
I think, again, but then again, we're talking G.I. Joe physics here.
So if that's just dropping a cylinder, you can make it more destructive by just making it more streamlined and just reducing the drag coefficient.
Yeah, I imagine like it might do that, to be honest.
Yeah, so if you could do that, then you could increase its power by a factor of, 100.
Yeah, but that still wouldn't really put it close to...
But then if you increased it by 100, that's like, 10 tons of TNT, which is... Yeah, you're still not like anywhere near like 15,000 tons. But that's still a lot of tons.
It's still a deterrent.
Like, I can't really visualize what 10 tons of TNT looks like.
Not many people generally do.
You know, that's a pretty big bomb. And you've not actually... Like, the difficult part is just getting it into space. And the rest of it is just, can I point it and can I drop it?
Yeah.
Because you don't even have to fire it.
But
right?
By that stage, we've got a space elevator. And we've got an orbital space station.
Yes.
I think it's a lot easier.
So you could certainly deliver, like, strikes that produce... I don't know if a 10-ton explosion would give you any radiation. It's not clear to me what the sort of the threshold is for generating radiation.
But it would be a really interesting sort of alternative.
Mm.
Like I said, if you could get that accuracy...
Yes.
Who knows? I mean, like I said, in the movie, they basically just say, yeah, we're just dropping... It's literally just dropping big chunks of metal on people from above.
Yeah.
The same way, like, tossing a penny off the top of the Eiffel Tower.
Yeah.
Or the one in New York that I forgot.
The Empire State
Building. The Empire State Building, there we go.
So, yes, in a sense, that is a clean weapon, right? All you're doing is you're taking the kinetic energy of the rod and turning it into...
Yeah.
Well, it's impacting with the Earth, and that energy then has to become something else, right? So you would generate an explosion. And that would generate a pressure wave. Like 10 tons of TNT, I think that's probably quite a wide area of destruction. Like, it's not a nuclear bomb, but you're talking like a city block.
And sometimes that's all you need. To take out... And this is going to sound very cynical. To take out a political structure...
Mm-hmm.
And this is like a sort of almost like micro versions of what we were talking about with the asteroids hitting in the first episode.
Yes.
Where you've got that kind of, your crater, I can't remember the word you used.
The transient crater.
Transient crater to start with, and then you've got the energy that comes out as it collapses in it.
So it's exactly the same physics as happening, it's just that you've got a slightly different, so you've got a rod shape, so it's not just a big blob, so you're kind of inserting that energy into the ground at a very specific point. So you may not get a crater in the same way. It'd be more like a drill point through. But
the outward effects would still be...
You're still delivering that energy. Like if you imagined it hitting the roof of a building, the building's going to go, ouch, I've been hit by something very, very fast. And it's going to have to like generate shockwaves in the building that then, like let that energy go out. And if that shockwave is strong enough, the building just blows up.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Blows apart.
Cool.
Wow. Quick maths.
Yeah, there you go.
That's why he's on the show.
That's exactly what. Whereas I'm in the first episode going, in 10 weeks' time. It's just multiplying by two.
I was just like curious, like if something as simple, and I know I did a very brief research, that there is aspects of this clean bomb idea where essentially you go up high enough and just drop a big chunk of something onto people in the shape of a missile or a bomb. But it's not packing anything.
And it's kind of addressed, I think, in... Is it The Expanse? Have you guys watched The Expanse?
It is mentioned in... As a kinetic...
kinetic weapon.
Kinetic weapon. But I haven't actually seen The Expanse.
So the idea in The Expanse is that you have, Earth and Mars and other bodies in the solar system have their own governments and political systems, and they're kind of at war by the end of the story. And they have an unspoken rule is that you just don't drop stuff down the gravity well, because the cheapest way to destroy like large parts of another planetary system is just to take an asteroid and just flick it, right? And it's kind of inferred that they can do that. They can, you know, they can mine asteroids. They can push them where they want to go. The cheapest way to cause huge amounts of damage, if you can do that, is just nudge it down the gravity well of the planet you don't like. Bang. Same physics applies.
Yeah. And we're back to that discussion about Star Trek Discovery, where you're drawing that bigger thing, or drawing, using that gravity against itself.
I suppose it's a similar sort of concept to just bullets.
It is. It's the exact same. The reason that bullets hurt is because they're really fast.
Yeah.
Right?
But there's no... Nothing beyond that. It's just the speed that they're hitting you.
It's just energy. Right?
And it drills in, like you said.
Yeah,
you know?
It's the exact same thing. It's like hitting the planet with a bullet.
Because there's no explosion or radiation or anything like that. It's just an object at speed.
Yeah. It's an object travelling at a high speed, but not such a high speed that it causes, you know, a fireball to be generated. When the fireball gets generated, then you get, you know, very powerful heat and you get the radioactive stuff coming out of that fireball. But if it's quick, but not explodey like that, then
my next sort of like veer off was to sort of look at other non-explosive weapons, things like railguns, which are using magnets to accelerate things rather than gravity.
Yeah,
and essentially it's the same thing, but
it's another form of bullet. You're just using something to accelerate a projectile to speed. When that projectile hits the other thing, it causes damage.
Yeah. So with rail guns, is it still like metal objects or whatever, and they're just fired through loads of magnets to pick up pace?
Yeah. It's just accelerating something using a magnetic field in it. Well, I mean, it doesn't always have to be magnets, but you know, that's the kind of, that's the classic one, especially for like space warfare, because it's really hard to get things to accelerate. Because if you just do an explosion, then you know, you do an explosion here, your bullet goes that way, but you go that way. Right, so you're looking for ways to make sure that you can still launch a projectile without being launched.
Which means you need a slower acceleration time, or a longer acceleration time to gently get you going.
Yeah, to get you going without pushing you back. Yeah. Like that. Yeah.
What was I watched? I think it was in Love, Death, Robots, and there was something like that where she had to... Her hand ended up exposed to the air, but she broke it off and used it to create that opposite force to push herself back towards her ship, kind of thing.
Yeah, and that's like conservation momentum. You push some of your momentum that way, you had zero to start with, it means you get momentum in the opposite direction. Yeah.
Which was, it was grim to watch, but it was quite clever as well.
Yeah. So one other form of weapon of mass destruction that doesn't involve explosions is nanotechnology.
Yes.
Which we didn't cover.
No.
So you could design... You know, in principle, in the future, you could design small machines that go and do things, right? And the classic version of this, which when it goes wrong, is that you design a machine that makes more machines.
Yeah.
And it's like, okay, I'm going to make a copy of myself. I'm made mostly of carbon. I'm going to go find some carbon, eat that, turn it into a machine. If you get too many of those doing it, we're made of carbon. That's a good way to get rid of us, is to turn us into these machines by eating our carbon.
Stargate.
The replicators.
The replicators.
Yeah. So they're like a kind of a larger scale version of this kind of weapon. And so nanotechnology, if it's put in the wrong hands, if one person just says, right, I'm going to ping this nanobot in the wrong place with the wrong set of instructions, you could cause massive damage. And there's no radiation involved, but you could completely rewrite the surface of wherever it is you've deployed this thing.
There's also an interesting sort of weapon research, when you look at the biological things and look into the genetics, the being able to almost pick who is affected by a specific thing.
Yeah.
Because you could create it. And I've seen it in, I think it turns up in Person of Interest, actually, where essentially you create a toxin or something, which is literally targeted on someone's genetics to the point where it's like anyone with blue eyes will be killed.
Yeah.
And it will die. Or someone with a specific heritage, or someone with a specific chromosome, or literally down to the genetic level. I mean, that's...
From my understanding, we're not there yet.
No.
Scientifically, but I don't think it's completely impossible.
No.
Yeah.
And then there's a mindset there where you could essentially release that toxin into an environment and be like, yeah, sure, well, all of these people are going to be fine.
Yeah.
They'll all survive.
But these people who've got blue eyes
there goes blue eyes from the thing.
Yeah.
And that's again, it's essentially a clean one because you will still leave survivors.
Yeah.
The survivors you want to have survive.
Mm.
That's, it's kind of like a more refined version of what happens. I'm sure it's in Inferno by Dan Brown. I don't know if either of you have read it.
Oh.
Where
I've watched the film.
The main sort of bad guy that, or not bad guy, but the main, yeah, I suppose he is a way sort of portrayed as a bad guy, is obsessed with overpopulation in the world. And in the end of the story,
there's a better way to deal with that. It all involves gloves and jewellery.
What's that?
There's a better way to deal with overpopulation. It involves a glove.
Oh, right, yeah, yeah, and giving it to Attenborough.
Yeah.
He releases something into the atmosphere which basically completely randomly selects half the people of the world are going to end up sterile. And it's, again, there's no specific DNA aimed in that, but the distribution method, I can't remember it, but it turns out when they get to the end point to stop this happening, it's too late. It's already happened, kind of thing.
And even then, like, something as simple as that is just preventing reproduction.
Yeah.
Like that is essentially a weapon of mass destruction.
It's almost the genophage.
Yeah, exactly. You go into the Mass Effect, and the genophage that affects the
Krogans.
The Krogans is exactly that. You prevent them from reproducing,
yeah.
Prevent them from anything, and like that's actually that's a heartbreaking part of that story.
It's a rough story, but the positives from it is the Krogans became, as a result of the genophage, the Krogans became less like barbarians and less primal and sort of developed like culture,
races. The whole idea of the Krogans is that they were genetically modified race to start with that was just bred for war,
mm-hmm.
and then they got out of control, at which point you're going, well, how do we stop these guys? And the answer was stop them breeding because they're just breeding and breeding and breeding and going to war. And the genophage essentially absolutely completely controls that, because I think it's something like 1 in 10.
Oh, it's fair.
Only one in a huge number of Krogan children survives.
Mm.
It's actually heartbreaking to get to it. It's one of my favourite. Like, Mass Effect has so many great aspects to it.
Mm.
But you do get that point later on where you're like, we can fix this.
But it's such a harsh fix, and it's eugenics, right?
Exactly, eugenics is
It's a horrible discussion to have about, you know, who gets to have children and the rights of individuals and all that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But I think that's why it's a fascinating factor in that storyline, because you meet these characters who are just like, and again, yeah, I mean, when they have affected by this genophage and they aren't reproducing as much, you suddenly start to see them sort of stop and go, we need to rethink this, we need to, and then every life does become,
and a new generation of Krogan emerges that are more willing, like less inclined to just fight everything, and more willing to become scientists and things like that.
Exactly. Right. Cool. Yeah, no, that was an example I'd absolutely forgot about.
Yeah.
No, I
think on that, we'll draw this one to a close.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. Done pretty well. Yeah.
No, I've enjoyed this one. I've not participated as much, but I've definitely enjoyed it.
Yeah.
So, usual sign-offs. Forgan, where can people find you on the internet?
You can find me on Twitter. I am at DH4GAN, and that's number 4.
Excellent, thanks. Stu?
As ever, at Barg the Ogre on the Twitters. Again, not doing a huge amount. Probably a little bit more by now, because it'll be four, five, six, 7 weeks in.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I'll probably have a little bit more interest in
it. Yeah, cool. And you can find us at Sci-Fi Podcast, or you can find our website at fcpod.net/The Science of Fiction, where you'll also find all the other great shows from the Fair City Podcast Network on there as well. And that's it from me, so say goodbye, everyone.
Goodbye, everyone.
That was so out of sync, it sucked. Let's try again.
No, we're not editing it.
We're not.
No,
I wasn't editing it. I was letting people hear you try again.
No, I think we're done now.
Yeah, we're done.
Say bye-bye, everyone.
Bye-bye, everyone.
Bye-bye, everyone.